Welcome to Hanchuck Targets History. I'm your host, Tim Hanchuck. Thanks for joining me this episode. You know, I've been teaching high school history for way too many years, and I love talking about this stuff. So let me share with you some interesting, unique, and little-known historical events. I know you'll be entertained, and if you're not careful, you just might learn something too. So, let's lock and load and take a shot at that target of history and see what we can hit. Let's take a walk down range and see what the target shows us. Well, it looks like today we hit on World War II again. Specifically, we'll be examining one of those obscure weapons that seem like a great idea on paper, but fail to live up to their potential in real life. If I asked you to name the very first weapon that had an intercontinental range, you'd probably say, well, it must be the Soviet Union's R-7 ICBM, first launched in 1957. As the name implies, it was an intercontinental ballistic missile. But if you thought about it for a minute, you'd maybe say, wait, planes are weapons, so it must be the American B-36 Peacemaker strategic bomber. It first flew in 1949 and had an intercontinental range. But neither of these guesses would be correct. In fact, during World War II, Japan possessed and employed a weapon that could be launched from Japan and hit the continental United States. This would be the Fugo, or fire balloons, which were sometimes also called balloon bombs. Let's see how such a thing came to be. The concept for this weapon was rather brilliant in its simplicity. A large balloon carrying explosives would be released in Japan, and the prevailing winds would carry it to North America. There it would release its explosives to damage buildings, kill people, or cause fires. The task of creating such a weapon went to the Imperial Japanese 9th Army's No. 9 Research Laboratory. This was headed by Major General Tsuyoshi Kasaba, and the actual build team would be led by Technical Major Teiji Takada. Weather balloons were used to gather data to see if it was even possible for a bomb-carrying balloon to reach the U.S. As the Japanese ran these tests, they discovered something amazing. Above Japan, there existed a strong current of winter air that blew at a high speed at altitudes of over 30,000 feet. This current would later become known as the jet stream, and the Japanese realized that it could carry a large balloon across the Pacific in about 3 days. We're talking about a distance of over 5,000 miles. Once they knew it was feasible, Takada and his team set about overcoming the numerous technological problems such an endeavor entailed. First of all, they would fill the balloons with hydrogen. Now the thing is, when a hydrogen balloon is warmed by the sunlight, it will expand and the balloon will rise. Conversely, when it becomes cooler at night, the balloon contracts and begins to descend. Was this a big deal? Yeah, it was. Remember, the balloon had to stay above 30,000 feet to take advantage of the jet stream. To remedy this issue, engineers devised a ballast system controlled by an altimeter. Sandbags would be hung from an aluminum frame, and if the balloon fell below 30,000 feet, the altimeter would electrically fire a small charge to release pairs of sandbags. They were released in pairs to keep the apparatus balanced. Conversely, if the balloon rose above 38,000 feet, the altimeter would electrically activate a valve and vent off some of the hydrogen. An electronic control system was set up to come into action after 3 days. It was assumed that by this time, the ballast would be used up and the balloon would be over the U.S. A final charge released whatever kind of bombs were being carried on the frame and ignited a 20-meter-long fuse. This fuse would burn for almost an hour and a half before setting off a small flash bomb attached to the balloon itself. This would ignite the hydrogen filling the balloon and completely destroy it, so it was like a self-destruct mechanism. All told, the balloon would need to carry about 1,000 pounds of gear and munitions. While a variety of bombs in varying quantities were used, some of the most common ones to be carried were 15-kilogram high explosive bombs, 12-kilogram thermite incendiary bombs, or smaller 5-kilogram incendiaries. The bomb load per balloon might be small, but the Japanese planned to launch a great many of them. Plus, there was always the potential for one small incendiary to cause a great conflagration in the right circumstances. On top of this, let's not forget that Japan was still looking for revenge for the Doolittle raid that took place back in 1942. Now here's another scary thought. During the war, the Japanese had been creating biological weapons. This was mainly done by the infamous Unit 731, the Imperial Japanese Army's covert biological and chemical warfare R&D unit operating in northeastern China. They were cultivating large stockpiles of anthrax, Y. pestis, which is the plague, and had enough cowpox virus to infect the entire United States. What makes this fact even more scary was that using these biological weapons on the fire balloons was planned right from the start in 1944. Fortunately, Emperor Hirohito would not permit the use of biological weapons. This decision came on October 25, 1944, which was still a little over a week before the first balloon's launch. Good thing, too, because biological weapons being deployed against the U.S. would have been an extremely serious threat. The balloon envelope itself would be about 10 meters in diameter and hold 540 cubic meters of hydrogen. The first balloons, the ones mainly used to gather meteorological data, were made from rubberized silk, which was a common balloon-making material at this time. This worked okay, but by the time production of the weaponized balloons began, a new material was being used. It was known as washi, a type of paper made from mulberry bushes that was impermeable and extremely tough. Balloons made from washi actually had less gas leakage than the rubberized silk ones. The problem with washi, though, was that it was only available in sheets about the size of a poster board. That means that a whole mess of sheets would need to be glued together in 3 or 4 layers to form the balloon. That's a lot of gluing, especially considering the fact that the Army ordered the construction of 10,000 of them. Much of the construction was performed by teenage schoolgirls throughout Japan, working in large indoor spaces like sumo halls, gyms, and theaters. As balloon envelopes and components were built and assembled, the Japanese Army created a balloon launch organization made up of 3 battalions. The 1st battalion would be stationed at Otsu and man 9 launch stations. They'd also have a hydrogen gas generating facility right next to it. The 2nd battalion was stationed at Ichinomiya, and the 3rd at Nikkoso. Each of these battalions would have 6 launch stations, and would have to ship in their hydrogen from 2 other plants a little ways away. Through their meteorological tests, the Japanese discovered that the best time to launch balloons was just after a high-pressure front had passed by. They also realized that launches had to take place between November and March, because this was when the jet stream was blowing its fastest. They figured they could hope for maybe 50 days out of this time frame when conditions would be suitable for launches. It was also estimated that all the launch stations combined could send off 200 balloons a day. You do the math. Now you see why they ordered 10,000 to be built. On November 3rd, 1944, the first bomb-carrying balloon was launched, with Major Takata watching. More would follow that first one as the program got off the ground. Pun intended. A few of the balloons, especially in the early days, carried radio sound equipment rather than bombs. A radio sound is a battery-powered telemetry instrument. It transmitted a radio signal to receiver stations on the ground. Using different direction-finding stations and triangulating the signal allowed the balloon to be tracked and gave the Japanese a fairly good estimate of the balloon's progress to the United States. As I just said, the Japanese had to launch in winter to take advantage of the jet stream's highest velocity, But doing this also hampered how destructive these bombs might be. Think about it. In the winter, the Pacific Northwest gets its heaviest amount of precipitation. That meant that incendiary bombs had little chance of causing massive forest fires. The forests were either snow-covered or quite damp. On November 4th, a U.S. Navy patrol craft found one of the early radiosonde balloons floating off the port of Los Angeles. At first, they weren't quite sure what it was or where it came from. But by the end of November, more balloons had been found in Montana and Wyoming, causing national and state agencies to be alerted. The balloons continued to arrive and were found all across the western part of the U.S., with some even traveling far inland to places like Iowa, Kansas, and the outskirts of Detroit, Michigan. Balloons were also found in most of Canada's western provinces, and even northern Mexico. When balloons were spotted flying overhead, fighters from the Navy or Army Air Force were often scrambled to try to shoot them down. Surprisingly, this was much more difficult than one might think. Remember, the balloon was traveling rather quickly at an altitude of over 30,000 feet. That's tough for a World War II era fighter to intercept, as many U.S. fighters might take between 8 and 12 minutes to reach this altitude based on their rate of climb. All told, less than 20 balloons were shot down. The thing that worried the Americans the most was the threat of wildfires in the forests along the Pacific coast. To be ready to deal with this threat, the Army put together what was known as the Firefly Project. It was made up of 2,700 troops, including 200 paratroopers from the all-black 555th Parachute Battalion. These men would be positioned at key points and would be used for firefighting missions, with the 555th paratroopers serving as smoke jumpers. The cool thing about the Firefly Project, on top of its success in battling blazes, was that it coordinated and unified fire suppression communications between federal and state agencies. The equipment and tactics used would greatly influence how the U.S. Forest Service approached dealing with wildfires after the war, right up to this very day. So all in all, the balloon bombs were not too successful, but that didn't stop the Americans from worrying. As I said earlier in the episode, all it would take would be for one bomb to land in the right set of circumstances, and you'd have a major problem on your hands. And don't think the men of the Firefly Project were just sitting around at base. They did fight numerous fires. And there were some very scary near misses. One of the most potentially disastrous ones happened in March of 1945. A balloon bomb descended in Washington State near the Hartford site. This was a production facility for the Manhattan Project and contained the first full-scale plutonium production reactor. This site actually produced the plutonium for the bomb tested at the Trinity site, as well as the one dropped on Nagasaki. The one used on Hiroshima, used uranium. But anyway, the balloon bomb descended into some power lines that supplied electricity to the reactor cooling pumps. This caused the lines to short out and shut down the pumps. Fortunately, backup safety devices restored power quickly. But just think if they didn't. There could have been a core meltdown. And we all saw how that worked out in places like Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. So, the U.S. was aware of these balloon bombs and was trying to do what they could to mitigate any damage they might cause. But for a long time, no one could figure out where they were coming from. Authorities just couldn't believe that they came directly from Japan. The popular belief was that the balloons must have been launched from West Coast beaches by landing parties from Japanese submarines. But then, some of the sandbags carried by the balloons were recovered. They were turned over to the Military Geology Unit of the U.S. Geological Survey. Who even knew such a unit existed? Anyway, researchers ran all kinds of science-y examinations on the sand, trying to find the types and distribution of diatoms, and other microscopic sea creatures, and its mineral composition. We all know how poor I am in science, so suffice to say, the data gathered told the researchers that the sand came from Japan. Armed with this information, aerial reconnaissance flights located the potential launch sites in Japan, and more importantly, found two of the three hydrogen production plants. These plants were bombed into rubble by B-29 raids in April of 1945. Now, I said the U.S. was aware of these balloons and their potential threat. What I really should have said was that the U.S. authorities were aware. The general public was left in the dark. Let's face it, Japanese weapons that could actually hit U.S. soil had the potential for a big-time psychological effect on the country. On top of this, the government wanted to prevent the Japanese from knowing how effective the balloons might be. A few news stories did run in December and the first days of January 1945. In response to this, the Office of Censorship asked all newspapers and radio stations to make no mention of any balloon bomb incidents. The media cooperated from that point onward, keeping any incidents out of the news. Keeping Japan from gathering evidence of the balloon bomb's effectiveness worked well. They thought the entire operation was a complete and total failure. On top of this, it was proving to be quite expensive, and as I already said, two of the three hydrogen production plants had been destroyed in April. As a result, the operation was shut down. Now, the news blackout about the balloons sure did a great job in keeping the Japanese from discovering how effective they were. But this blackout also left the American public unaware of a potential danger. And that led a group of innocent people to their death. On May 5, 1945, Archie Mitchell, a pastor at the Bly Christian and Missionary Alliance Church in Southern Oregon, and his pregnant wife, Elsie, were driving up to Gearhart Mountain. They had five of their Sunday school students with them, all between the ages of 11 and 14. The plan was to have a picnic, enjoy some nature, and go home. The group was forced to stop near Bly because of road construction. Elsie and the kids got out of the car to look for a good place for their picnic, while Archie drove a little farther to find a parking spot. In a clearing, Elsie and the kids found a strange, deflated balloon lying on the ground and went to investigate. As Archie was getting out of his car, he heard two explosions and rushed to the scene. The balloon's bombs had gone off, killing four of the children instantly. Elsie died as Archie tried to smother the fire on her burning clothes. The fifth child survived the explosion, but died a short while later from extensive burns. Later on, military personnel and a bomb disposal expert surmised that the balloon must have failed to release its bombs or self-destruct, and instead had just been lying there. They guessed that perhaps one of the group nudged part of the apparatus with their foot, inadvertently setting it off. After this, the media blackout was lifted. Remains and wreckage of balloons continued to be discovered well after the war ended. Eight more were found in the 1940s, three in the 50s, and two in the 60s. In 1978, parts of one were discovered in Oregon. In October of 2014, one was found in British Columbia and had to be detonated by a Royal Canadian Navy Ordnance Disposal team. And as late as 2019, the remains of another were also found in British Columbia. As I said earlier, this operation sounded brilliant on paper, but failed to live up to its potential in real life. And the Japanese were not the only ones to think of using balloons to deliver bombs in World War II. Between 1942 and 1944, the British used similar, though much simpler, balloon bombs against Nazi Germany. But talking about those, well, that would be another story. And there you have it, kind listeners. Thank you for tuning in. You know, if you like this episode, please tell your friends and check out some of my other episodes. And I very much look forward to talking with you again next week.